Judiciary, meeting March 25th, 1987 at 5 p.m. in Hearing Room A. Tonight we're having a public hearing and work session on Senate Bills 20 and 21.
And Hamby and Fry are subcommittee to take public testimony on Senate Bills 20 and 21. The first three witnesses, Raymond Mensing, Tom Cooney, and Bob Shoemaker.
Let me see if they're outside.
They're out there talking to the rest of my committee members. I have soon. Karen O'Connell here. Come on up, will you, please?
Thank you. Okay.
No, you're not. I just called somebody else now. Okay, go ahead, please.
I'm Karen O'Connell, State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and I'm here as an advocate and representative of long-term care residents. I am here in support of Senate Bill 20. Every citizen has a right to protect their body from mechanical invasion. That is basically what this bill would accomplish. The common title, Death with Dignity, implies we are now going to give people a choice in the manner and duration of their death, or between death and not dying. Possibly that is why opponents of this legislation still say it smells of euthanasia. However, this conclusion is erroneous. The Ombudsman Program supports this bill because, one, we should have the basic right not to be traumatized if that is our choice. And two, leaving a legacy of uncertainty and doubt for loving family members and friends can be cruel and destructively burdensome. As a nurse, I share the excitement of every new technical advancement in medicine, but I also worry that through our ambition we have failed to balance progress with common sense. I have attached a case example to this testimony. It was part of the testimony given last year at a hearing on this bill. I would like the committee to also consider some changes to the bill. One, on page 2, line 24, remove or the cost of procedures. This implies the third choice is related to monetary considerations. Somehow this is unpalatable. We could possibly discourage this choice because it implies selfishness. In addition, the other two choices do not mention cost savings. Two, on page 3, section 6, and on page 4, section 7, we object to the priority ranking for withdrawing or withholding life-sustaining procedures. Few nursing home residents have a living spouse. In fact, only 12% do. And in the second priority, many guardians do not even know the residents they are representing, as they have been appointed by a court. The third priority is the children, and unfortunately our program continues to witness decisions made by children on behalf of their institutionalized parents out of concerns other than the parents' best interests, such as cost savings and estate or inheritance preservation, with little attention seriously given to quality outcomes. The fourth priority, the parent, is almost non-existent for the long-term care resident. The other change would be in the definition of incapacitated person. We feel that should be changed and the 15-year age limit removed. A person 15 years age or older on page 1, line 17 should be removed and then allow the rest of the definition to stand. I think the second definition would apply to everybody. I don't think you need the 15-year limit in there. Thank you for this opportunity to be heard on this major piece of legislation.
Questions for committee? Thank you very much.
Ms. O'Connell?
Counsel.
Without the prioritization on in Section 6, how would you fashion it?
They asked me that question a year ago at the hearing, and I said I couldn't answer them. I didn't know. And today I can't answer that question either. I had thought possibly an impartial ethics board might be an answer. Of course, that may take a lot of time. I also thought that maybe along with a family member for the nursing home resident, there could be another person who has no financial gains that would assist in making the decision. The first four priority rankings just really does not apply to, well, three of them just almost totally don't apply to the nursing home resident. And with this segment of the population possibly needing these decisions at a higher incidence, I'm not sure what the answer is, but we have concerns about that priority ranking.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, commencing, Cooney, Mr. Shoemaker.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ray Mensing, and I'm the general counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals. With me is Bob Shoemaker, who is a member of the interim committee, and Tom Cooney, the Cooney crew in Withal. Mr. Shoemaker will make a presentation now of what we've been working on during this process.
Good afternoon again. I'm pleased to be back. The three of us, Mr. Cooney representing the Oregon Medical Association as its attorney, Mr. Mensing representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals as its attorney, and I as a representative of the task force and an attorney, focused on the Senate Bill 20 and 21 in the form submitted by the task force to try to correct essentially a number of technical problems, housekeeping amendments for the most part. And I hope you have in your packet today a copy of these two bills in hand engrossed form with those amendments in place. They're two 8.5 by 11 double spaced typed packets. Do you have them? Yeah, I don't propose to go through all of the changes here because I think they're self-explanatory. The deletions are bracketed and the additions are underlined. There are, as always seems to be true, a few corrections even of those, which I would like to put on the record. And then there's one definition, which I'd like to talk about at some small length. First, the corrections. In Senate Bill 20, in Section 7, these pages are not really numbered. You just have to find it. We wanted to make Section 6 and Section 7 track each other because they're the two situations that deal with a patient with no directive. And so we, I think, erroneously included subsection 1B of Section 7, which would say that before you could withdraw life support from the comatose patient, you would have to inform that patient of the situation to the limit of his capacity for understanding and perceive that he has no objection. That makes sense in the Section 6 situation, the patient who's in the active and natural process of dying but is not comatose. We think very strongly that you should confront the patient with a decision to withdraw life support. It makes it impossible to go around the patient's back on doing such a thing. With the comatose patient, it's different. That patient is not conscious, so it's a totally useless act. And so we think that that sub B, Section 7.1b should be deleted. In Section 12, which defines the offenses that we're talking about here, in sub 1 of Section 12, I think through clerical error, the drafting does not quite accomplish what we intend. We intend that it should be a Class A felony to, without authorization of the declarant, to willfully alter or forge a directory, directive, or conceal or destroy a revocation with the intent and effect of causing a withholding or withdrawal which hastens death. So should strike the words to cause in line 4 and substitute the words and effect of causing. And that same change should be made in the equivalent section of Section 21.
Mr. Shoemaker?
Yeah.
On this issue, as to the crime classification, you've introduced a new element of hastening the death. Hastening the death element is not in SB 20, and it isn't in current law. Can you comment on that, and also comment on if a person has the intent and effect of withholding, but by some fortuitous circumstance, death is not hastened by that action, what your construction of that offense would be?
As drafted, that would not be an offense. In other words, what we're suggesting, and I guess I should say here, I'm not speaking for the task force at this point, I'm just speaking for myself, but I think Mr. Mensing and Mr. Cooney are speaking for their organizations in asking that it be a Class A felony, that is a homicide, only if there is the effect of hastening death, as well as the intent. Now, you have suggested that it might be some consideration to having an additional offense as a Class B homicide if there's only the intent and not the effect. I don't know that the three of us have thought about that enough to comment on it.
Thank you. I didn't mean to stop your flow.
That's okay. No, I'm glad you did. So that change would be made in both the bills. And then in Senate Bill 21, there's a clerical error in Section 8, sub 4. And this is the provision that says, in effect, that the Act does not authorize the attorney in fact to consent to health care or to the withdrawal of health care if the principal, whether or not incapacitated, objects. Now, as originally drafted, the withholding or withdrawal was limited to health care necessary to keep the principal alive. And we're suggesting taking that out so that if the principal objects to withdrawal of any health care, that would control. The intent of that amendment was carried through in the first deletion that you'll see in lines 4 and 5, but not further down where they substituted life-sustaining procedures for the phrase of the health care. And do you see where I'm at, Mr. Kramer?
I lost you. Can you redirect me?
All right. Line 57, strike life-sustaining procedures and delete the brackets that surround of the health care, line 56 and 57. Okay? And that's just a clerical mistake that crept in. Now, the other substantive point I'd like to speak to is the
Mr. Shoemaker, let me just ask you a question while we're on that that change.
Okay.
If a principal objects, then the power of attorney is void. Is that correct?
That isn't the result of this subsection. I think that's somewhere else in here. That would revoke it.
Let's just...
Regardless of where it is, I think the thought is that maybe that should not have that effect, but it should merely overcome that particular decision but not revoke the power.
Well, I guess what I'd like you to explain to the committee is the effect of the next line, beginning the end of line 57 and then 58 and 59.
Such a case is governed by the law that would apply if there were no power of attorney for health care.
And let's assume that Senate Bill 20 was in effect. I guess what I'm asking you is, would then other persons, for instance, a person under Section 6 who has no directive and is incapacitated, a person under Section 7 who is comatose, other persons, not the power of attorney, would then have input into the decision making?
It wouldn't arise in the Section 7 situation because the principal could not object because he's comatose. It could arise in the Section 6 situation. I think, as a practical matter, you wouldn't have what you're concerned about. I mean, here you would have an agent appointed who says something should be done. Let's say that he does not want to withdraw. And the principal is trying to pull tubes out. And so that's perceived as an objection to that decision. I think it would be very, very unlikely that in that situation where the agent who's given that authority is saying, I don't think it's appropriate to do this, that some collateral person can come in and ask that it be done and that would overcome and that the doctor would go along with that kind of a direction. Because remember that Section 6 is not a mandatory section. It's a permissive section. And I think as a practical matter, when you're in those situations, you're just not going to be withdrawing life support unless there's a pretty clear consensus among the attending group. You may overcome some person who's way off in left field sometimes, but that's just not the way those things happen.
Thank you.
So I think that's the response. The other point I'd like to speak to is the definition of active and natural process of dying. You will see on page 1 of the amended version of Senate Bill 20, beginning with line 12, a proposed definition. And it defines active and natural process of dying as an incurable condition which, regardless of the application of life-sustaining procedures, will, as determined by the attending physician in accordance with accepted standards of medical practice, produce death within a reasonably short time. As applied in the Section 6 situation, now this is the patient without a directive and without a power of attorney, we think that that is the appropriate definition. In other words, you shouldn't be withdrawing life support from a patient without a directive if life support can keep that person alive for an appreciable length of time. The Section 6 case is a person who is about to die anyway. We're talking about hours, maybe in some cases a day or two. And so we want to check the possibility of withdrawing life support when it would substantially extend life for a person without a directive. We don't want this act to permit the baby doe situations, for one thing, where a spinal bifida baby without life-sustaining procedures would die, but with them will live for a long time. We do not want that kind of situation to occur under this act. On the other hand, a patient who is in command of himself and is giving a directive, while fully rational, should be able to say that if I'm in the active and natural process of dying, without the application of life-sustaining procedures, let me die. Because that's really a large part of what we're talking about here. The patient who does not want to be kept going and knows that and thinks it through in advance and signs a directive to that effect. So to use the regardless language throughout the bill would have the unfortunate effect of not allowing a person to, without a lot of thinking the thing through and drawing his own special directive, not allowing that person to direct that he doesn't want life-sustaining procedures, even if they will extend his life. So I suggest that maybe the way to handle that is to use the definition with the word without in it. Then when used in Section 6, add to it, regardless of the application of life-sustaining procedures, so that we have both standards. The broad one when you're making a directive and the narrow one when you don't.
Mr. Shoemaker, if the committee were to follow your recommendation with two standards, one for persons with directives, one for Section 6, it applies then not only to the baby Doe situations, but to any person.
That's true.
Who is incapacitated and without a director.
That's true.
So you would be much more limited if, for instance, your mother had no directive and was incapacitated, and you felt that to affect her wishes, you would like to have life-sustaining, or you'd like to request the attending physician to withdraw life-sustaining procedures. You would be much more limited in that situation under the interpretation that you're asking the committee to adopt.
That is true, and that's the price you pay. But I think it's the price on the other side, I think, is too heavy to pay. And can't do everything for everybody. So let me stop there and leave you with these hand-engrossed amendments to look at in your own time. But maybe, Mr. Cooney, if you could say a word or two about support of your organization of this.
Well, Mr. Shoemaker mentioned...
Tom, just a second before you start. I want to stick in an editorial comment. You know, I spent 10 weeks looking at Scott Gallant in the room and you in the room, and I thought, well, finally I got rid of that horrible liability insurance bill, and right off, first thing out of the box, there's Scott Gallant back there. And here's Tom Cooney. You are going to promise to talk about a new subject, aren't
yes,
you, Tom?
Yes, and very, very briefly. Just for the committee's information, after the interim task force met, we worked on that which was proposed by the task force, and the Medical Society supports both the amendments in Senate Bill 20 and 21. And I think it is the composite thinking of the three lawyers that represent the entities here. And that's all I have to say about it.
That's all you have to say, okay. Mr. Chairman, as for the Hospital Association, I have circulated this information to the Hospital Association members, asked for their input, and talking about some of the amendments which we've made. The Hospital Association also supports the bills with the amendments.
And let me put on another hat for a minute. I've also been serving on this matter as attorney on the bioethical task force of the Multnomah County Medical Society. And I can speak for that society in saying it supports the measures with these amendments.
Questions by committee members? Senator Wires?
Question of the gentleman from the Hospital Association. This definition of life-sustaining procedures includes, along with tube feeding, it also includes IVs, correct?
It would. It's the talking about the artificial means, this mechanical hydration, is the nutrition and hydration, is that the subject matter you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's my understanding from dealing with a case that fell in this area in my law practice, that if you, I was told by a nursing, a physician, and I guess it was, that, and somebody also that was an administrator in a nursing home, that if a person is in a coma and they've recently gone into the coma, and you remove the, there doesn't seem to be any hope for their recovery. Their brain is so damaged that they won't be regaining consciousness. And they're probably going to die in a couple of weeks or maybe longer. But if you remove the IV, they die faster because they dehydrate. But in the process of dying, their skin becomes very vulnerable, and that it becomes almost impossible to prevent bed sores, which I've forgotten the technical name for.
Decubitus ulcers.
Decubitus ulcers. And that this causes a morale problem with the nursing staff, having patients that they can't prevent from developing decubitus ulcers. I wondered if you could comment on that, and if that was one of the things discussed by the hospital people.
The whole subject of nutrition and hydration, how it's been done, is discussed, and there are many different opinions on it. The actual medical results, I can't speak to, not being a physician. The condition of persons observing patients in certain cases could be disturbing, but many of the people that operate in hospitals are used to seeing people in distress. Not that they're impassionate to it, it's just that that is part of the service that we provide and have to live with.
All right, any other questions? Senator Hamby.
Perhaps I should wait for the physicians, but I was just wondering of the three gentlemen if they felt they need to perhaps further define the term comatose. Because I recognize that there are many varying degrees of...
I think Dr. Gingrich is prepared to speak to that specific point.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right. Lois Miller, please.
Good evening. My name is Lois Miller, and I'm the chairperson for the Gerontological Special Interest Group of the Oregon Nurses Association. And my comments deal with an unamended bill, so some of this may not be applicable to the amendments. Among the purposes of ONA are to work for the improvement of health standards and the availability of health care services for all people, to foster high standards of nursing, and to stimulate and promote the professional development of nurses. I appear before you today to present testimony on behalf of ONA relating to Senate Bill 20 and 21. The American Nurses Association document, Nursing, a Social Policy Statement, states, "There is a social contract between society and the professions. Under its terms, society grants the professions authority over functions vital to itself and permits them considerable autonomy in the conduct of their own affairs. In return, the professions are expected to act responsibly, always mindful of the public trust. Self-regulation to assure quality in performance is at the heart of this relationship. It's the authentic hallmark of a mature profession. A code of ethics makes explicit the primary goals and values of the profession. When individuals become nurses, they make a moral commitment to uphold the values and special obligations expressed in their code of ethics. The code for nurses is based on a belief about the nature of individuals, nursing, health, and society. Nursing encompasses the protection, promotion, and restoration of health, the prevention of illness, and the alleviation of suffering in the care of clients, including individuals, families, groups, and communities. Since clients themselves are the primary decision makers in matters concerning their own health, treatment, and well-being, the goal of nursing action is to support and enhance the client's decision-making and self-determination in healthcare matters to the greatest extent possible. In this context, health is not necessarily an end in itself, but rather a means to a life that is optimal from the client's perspective. The Code of Ethics provides a framework within which nurses make ethical decisions and discharge their responsibilities to the public, to other members of the health team, and to the profession. ONA believes that competent adults have the right to participate in decisions relating to their health care, including the decision to have medical or surgical means or procedures to prolong their lives, provided, withheld, or withdrawn. The Oregon Nurses Association supports legislation that establishes statutes for providing, withholding, or withdrawing life-sustaining procedures, and that sets forth procedures to establish power of attorney for health care decisions related to death with dignity. ONA supports inclusion of mechanical and artificial provisions of nutrition and hydration in the concept of life-sustaining procedure. Based on recent court decisions and research on the effects of withdrawal of nutrition and hydration on the dying person, nutrition and hydration should be treated as other vital functions subject to withholding and withdrawal according to a person's decision. ONA has three concerns regarding Senate Bill 20, Section 4 sub 1, 5 sub 1, and 6 sub 1. On page 3, there is a provision in Section 4 sub 1, line 5, that a directive can be made when the declarant is cognitively stable. ONA supports that the directive can be
in the Portland area. And frankly, they don't see that there's really that much of a problem with current legislation. I think if we try to assume that Senate Bills 20 and 21 are actually going to help some liability problems for physicians, I think we're kidding ourselves. Okay. First off, under current statute, a patient may make a directive that the physician, well, that hopefully the physician and the family will follow. It's not cast in concrete as Senate Bills 20 and 21 are. Under current statutes, the physician has to build a consensus among the family and with the nursing personnel if he feels that life-sustaining measures should be withdrawn from a patient. You know, medicine is not necessarily robotics. Medicine still is an art. And the physician, in terms of this, has to make individual decisions in individual cases. You can't legislate for all cases and make amendments to try to fit them for all cases. So in the individual circumstance, the physician has to build a consensus among the nursing personnel. And quite often it's the nursing personnel that go to the physician and says, don't you think that we've done enough? If the family is opposed to the physician and to the nursing, to the recommendations that nutrition and hydration be withdrawn, the physician has a responsibility to follow the family's decisions. He can try to build a consensus and say that, look, your mother or your father told me in this directive a long time ago, they don't want this provided. Let's talk about this. Let's try to come to some type of decision. That's the way a physician is to act. If under SB 20 and 21, the family is totally opposed to the attorney in fact withdrawing life-sustaining measures for the patient, the family has no recourse. And if I'm the physician in the middle of that situation, and I've got the family on one side and the attorney in fact on the other side, and SB 20 and 21 says that I have to follow the attorney in fact and the family's opposed, I think I'm kidding myself to think that I might not be involved in some kind of legal maneuver.
Senator Cohn, if you can answer your question.
No, but that's okay.
All right.
Okay, but what I would like to say...
No, it's okay.
I would be glad to... I'm sorry for diverging.
Okay. Okay, that's all right.
So that I could give very succinctly a very short answer to her question.
Good.
Okay. And that is that I think that we should continue to presume that we should continue to have a presumption in favor of providing nutrition and hydration to a patient in a medical facility, and that nutrition and hydration may only be removed if the administration of hydration and nutrition unavoidably and in itself causes severe, intractable, or long-lasting physical pain, or if the patient is in the final stage of a terminal condition, and if death is imminent regardless of the administration of nutrition and hydration, and that the benefits of nutrition and hydration are clearly outweighed by the burdens and suffering to a qualified patient.
Any further questions, Senator Cohn? All right.
No, I'd just like to see that.
You'd like to see that?
I've got it here, maybe.
Is that written out now?
It can be provided.
All right, if you would, provide that to council, please. Dr. Sacco?
Yes, my name is Russell Sacco. I'm from Portland. You know, I think, Senators, that physicians both on both sides of this issue really kind of agree on how we care for terminally ill patients. I think we have different positions, but we basically have an agreement on the subject in the sense that none of us, first of all, want to harm anybody. We got a terminal patient, we just want to supply their comfort and relief of pain and try to maximize their enjoyable life from their perspective, and we certainly don't want to give them any unnecessary or unwarranted treatments. And we know for sure that every adult, any rational adult, has the right to refuse any treatment whatsoever right now. I don't care what their condition is, as long as they're rational. And Oregon law has supported us in this. Common law, there's a fund of common law that supports allowing people to die and removing life-sustaining measures right now. And we're not afraid of that. And there was a legislative statute enactment, 8 years ago or something like that, which kind of formalized that. And that supports that. That allows for the making of a directive. You know, I could run through and tell you all the kinds of people who might die that you certainly don't want die if this bill were passed as it is, but you know, you've heard them here and I've written them to you, and I'm not going to do that. Senate Bill 20 would be just kind of bad law. First of all, there's really no overwhelming majority of people who are running around out there signing directives when they have a legal right to do so now. It's been years, and I think I've seen one of my patients who is dying of cancer, and I see people who die of cancer not infrequently, that had a directive. One, I was really surprised, and he finally said, "But doc," in a final answer, "you do it. You know, you do what you think is best. I got this directive, but you do what you think is best." So right now we have law which allows people to write directives to allow them to die. We have a group of physicians who allow people to die. I suspect there's some that abuse both ends. And the other thing that's wrong with this law is it really affects everybody. The last statute only affected those who wanted to be affected. The last one said, if you want to write a directive, you can write one. Super. This one says, if you don't have a directive, here's the way we're going to let someone decide when we're going to cut off your care. That means everybody is affected by this law. You know, the problem really is, and if I were you, boy, I would run away from this. I wouldn't walk. I would run away from this one. This subject really is not amenable to statute. It's people are living and dying and are being taken care of.
Changing my mind tomorrow.
There's a lot of, you know, there's common law and there's statutory law, and it's good law right now. And I think you ought to just leave it alone.
What? All right, thank you. Yes, Councilor.
Dr. Stemfel, several states in the Uniform Act have addressed the pregnancy question by voiding the directive where the fetus could develop to the point of live birth with continued application of life-sustaining treatment. Would that satisfy your concern?
Yes, it sure would.
Thank you.
Dr. Finley, please. We have in our red book a letter. What number is it?
It should be under the tab Physicians in Favor, letter dated March 19th. In your red notebook.
Go ahead.
I'm Dr. Ronald Findlay. I'm a general practitioner from Eugene, Oregon. I've been practicing since August of 1953. As my professional life extends and my patients become more aged, I find that I have the privilege on an increasing basis of taking care of people in the dying process. I happened to be interested in this. I looked it up. In the last 18 days, I've had 6 people die. 3 were in at home, 2 were in nursing homes, and 1 was an acute hospital problem that resulted in death. I started a group on the study of bioethical problems 6 years ago. When we searched the literature, there were two articles written on bioethics problems. That was two. Indeed, we spent 6 months trying to define for ourselves what we meant by bioethics. I have continued to do that. I started a bioethics committee. I have been on a bioethics committee. I'm no longer on it. I appear here simply as an individual physician. On a personal level, I have experienced significant death in my home. I had an elderly aunt live with us in the periods of 1953-54, who I transferred to a nursing home 6 hours before her death, because at that time I was rather naive on the subject and I thought it was going to harm my children to experience a death in the home. That was naivete par excellence. It was stupid. Since that time, we have cared for a father-in-law, age 84, who died in our home, my 17-year-old son who died in our home, and my wife who died in our home 2 years ago. I talk to a lot of people about the dying process, and I talk to a lot of people who have great concerns about not having things done to them. And I think that we're quite comfortable in dealing with these problems, and I have many people coming to my office, in contradistinction to the gentleman you just heard, bringing in statements saying, I don't want any of those things done to me. And my answer to them is, go talk to your family so that they know where your head is, and that way that we're comfortable in caring about what they want. I'd like to speak first about Senate Bill 21, the power of attorney for health. I felt for the last 4 or 5 years that this was an appropriate way to go, that I think that the concept is good. I think that I am strongly in favor of the power of attorney because it in some instances there are members of the family who do not want to follow what the patient wants done for them. And so that it is possible for them to pick and choose the individual that they would like to have deal for them. I'm strongly in agreement. I can't repeat how strongly I am in agreement with including the mechanical and artificial provisions of nutrition and hydration under the bill. And I'll go back to Senator Wires, if he returns, comments, because I don't know where he's coming from, frankly. As a physician, I differentiate doing things to people and for people. I'm adamant that you do things for people and you don't do things to people. So I feel that when you maintain fluids, hydration, there's no calories in that. There's enough calories at the osmotic process so that you don't break down their red blood cells. So you add a little sugar to it or you add a little water to it. But there isn't enough calories in there to keep a kitten alive for an hour. It's fluid that you're doing. Now, no one in the dying process, unless they're in an acute care facility with a significant problem, receive alimentation, where you actually are putting in the amino acids and the materials which are actually nutrition and you can actually raise them. It requires a catheter into the major vessels, and this is not done unless you're in an active process of treating that person. So we're really talking about, when we talk about artificial provisions of nutrition and hydration, we're really talking about hydration, not nutrition in the ordinary sense. You're not going to put a subclavian catheter in a patient dying in the nursing home to maintain their nutrition. You just take care of their hydration. I have a couple problems, and I'm sorry, I don't have the amendments, and I only have the original bills. But there is one problem, and the problem that was brought up and alluded to relative to the revocation of the revocation of the attorney in facts position. it's interesting how in many, many cases, a person who is comatose, one family member out of 10 seems to be able to communicate with them. Nobody else can communicate, but one person seems to be able to communicate. And I'm not sure that how valid that communication is. You also see people who, when they become confused, and will either sit there and say no, 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 no all night, or they'll sit there and say yes, 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 yes all night. What's that mean? I don't think it means anything. So I think that it's important that the attorney, in fact, be locked into the position. I am concerned that some of them won't act. Some people will accept the job and won't carry it out. And I think that we need to talk to about this business of the incapacitated attorney, in fact, may be withdrawn from the, or may actually be asked to withdraw, even though the patient is comatose. I suggested that, and I gave this previously, that perhaps in line 17 and 21, it be changed from after the principal becomes incapacitated, the attorney in fact cannot withdraw except by also becoming incapacitated, to two sentences which states after the principal becomes incapacitated, the attorney in fact cannot withdraw, period. If the attorney in fact fails to act or ceases to function, the power of attorney is then nullified, and then it would go back to Senate Bill 20. I would foresee that a number of folks who would accept the job would not continue. I don't know. Since we haven't been had to face that, then I can't really tell you. Senate Bill 20 is, in my mind, definitely a step in the right direction. But it has some areas of which concern me greatly, and I think this is part of the problem that some other folks have seen in it. First, I do feel the need for better definition of the terminal state of the individual involved or upon those patients in the persistent vegetative state. You've probably heard these terms before, I'm sure you have, but let me just briefly sort of differentiate between the person in a terminal state and in a persistent vegetative state. The person in a terminal state is a person suffering from some organ problem, their terminal cardiac problem, a terminal lung problem, their kidneys have failed, they're not working on the dialysis, the cancer patient. Those people are in a position where there's nothing more basically you're going to be able to do with them. So they indeed are terminal. The persistent vegetative state, as you, I'm sure, know, are people, the automobile accident, stroke individual, and that type of person. Their central nervous system is basically gone, and they're living in their vegetative function in their brainstem. Now, these two groups of people are the people who eventually come to the point where it's obvious that they're going to come to the bitter end. The way the law is written, without a definition of this, indeed, it allows people to pick out folks who they might feel would not survive and who indeed are salvageable. So it needs to be defined, and the definition, I don't find it in this bill. So we sat down and wrote a suggested subsection. And I think the concept, I don't care the words, but the concept might go like this. If you went down to page, line 22 in the Senate Bill 20, and you see that there's a subsection 4, we would add a subsection 5. And subsection 5 might go something like this. The withdrawal of life-sustaining procedures would apply to individuals who are in an irreversible and progressive terminal condition and have no reasonable medical prospect of recovery from such condition. And individuals who have no prospect of recovery to the sapient cognitive state from a persistent vegetative condition. In other words, once the decision is made that this person, whatever their condition is not going to regain their cognitive function, that's the time when you say, hey, let's quit. Now, let me go back to and say I adamantly again would include nutrition and hydration. And if I may be redundant, since Dr. Wires has returned, let me go back to what he had said before and what he was talking about with nutrition. What I was saying before is there's a great misunderstanding about hydration and nutrition. Hydration is fluid. IVs are fluid. There are no calories in them. There's a piddling amount of salt, or there's a piddling amount of sugar, not enough to keep a moth alive for an hour, but a little there. But this has to do with maintaining the osmotic pressure so that when you pour water into the vein, you don't break the red blood cells down. Now, you don't give artificial nutrition through IVs. You do not give artificial nutrition through IVs. You give those through catheters that are complex amino acid materials, and these are used only in the very ill long-term patients in ICUs and in places like that, and occasionally in certain strange conditions where people actually give themselves their nutrition this way at home. Now, to answer your point very briefly and very simply and succinctly, I don't know who told you that by taking away nutrition you'd develop bed sores. By hydration. You do not, because if you take away hydration, the person who is ill, as we've defined, is going to die within 3 or 4 days, maybe 5. Now, bed sores are the way of life in nursing homes. The person that gets bed sores is a person who is nutritionally deprived because they don't eat well, and they are in nursing homes for long periods of time. But the death will occur before those folks will get bed sores. So I'm not sure where the bed sores business came from. Anyway, I believe that a definition as ours, perhaps as the gentlemen who have amended the bill multiple times, maybe they've defined it, but it isn't defined in this original bill at all. And so there needs to be a definition of who we're talking about. But I think that's a simple problem. What I've said is adequate. There are other things that are adequate. But anyway, there is. I agree with this business of 60 days as a duration of time. Anytime we hang days on things, you know, what's wrong with 59? The nurse was worried about whether this was total, whether you were comatose 60 days, but you had 30 days here and 20 days there and or whatever. Any day period is adequate, because this will vary depending on the situation, and it may take much more than 60 days to decide. It may take 10 days to decide. I don't think this creates a significant problem. I believe that these bills both are valuable.
Can I ask a question? Are you then assuming, if we move to your comments about the definitions,
mm-hmm.
then your statement alleges that we don't need any days at all. We should just drop any days.
I think
that
you
should drop reference to specific days at all.
And yes.
And leave
yes.
that up to the physician to make some determination of what.
Yeah, I agree. That I believe.
Okay.
That I believe. I don't have much else to say other than I agree with these bills. I am concerned a little bit about the one part where the magic of knowing whether a person changes their mind. Now, speaking to Senator Wires, this business of if a person tells you when they're coherent ahead of time, and if they've been in your office, and I have dozens and dozens of notes in my charts that people have kept and brought into me, hundreds of them, saying, I don't want those things to happen. And if then that person becomes comatose or confused or something, they simply aren't capable of making any decision at all. And I would trust what they told me originally several times way over by what they might say in a state of confusion. Indeed, these people don't remember. The classic instance of the surgery case. You never tell somebody the next day after surgery what they had. You give them a little bit of information, but you don't tell them, because the next day you come in and they ask you all over again, what did I have? And they say, you told you yesterday? I don't even remember you were in the room yesterday.
We're having that kind of a problem right now about something that Monday. Yeah. We know how that works. Could I say something? Senator Warren, I'm glad you do that. Want to ask me as one human being. But the concern I've raised...
Pardon me, could I extend just a little bit further? Let me tell you that I tell them 3 and 4 and 5 days down the line, and indeed some people will come back to the office 2 weeks later and say they don't remember a thing that happened to them in the hospital. And so you got to keep, you just keep sort of repeating and letting them know, and eventually it comes through to them. Pardon me, go ahead.
No, sir. Pardon me, I interrupted. I'm glad you, I don't have to repeat what you said. The concern I have, though, is putting it in the law that somebody who has written out a directive has to kind of burden on them to establish later that they are in a good mental state to revoke it. That's the problem I have. I don't have any problem with your following instructions that were given by a person when they were clear-headed and maybe not listening to it as much later. That's something between you and them and their family, perhaps. But to put it in the law that you can't revoke a formal legal...
It says you can revoke if they are... It should say if they're mentally competent, I would think.
But my concern is that burden is on them to show... I think the way the bill is, they can revoke, but the prior witness wanted to suggest that we make it. I better look at the provision. But whether it's in the bill or not, I don't like the idea of a provision where the burden is placed on the dying person to establish that they are mentally stable at the time they're trying to revoke. I don't want to belabor that with you.
Okay.
I appreciate your answer about it. Yeah, did you have anything
further? No.
Any further questions of Dr. Finley? All right, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We have one more witness, and that's Dr. Rogosin.
Senator Fry, members of the committee, it's... a pleasure to be here, and I come as a practicing internist in the Salem area, and as an internal medicine physician, I have a great deal of patients who are senior citizens, Medicare patients, and this difficulty of death and dying with dignity, is a common concern. It is not something that we see once every few years. It is something that is a frequent occurrence in my practice. Something that a lot of patients have shared with me and, in fact, brought living wills into the office. And in my office, we mark them in giant letters, red letters, that a living will is present in the chart. And those red letters are not infrequent in our office. So I was very interested in the legislation, read it, and have some concerns and comments. Basically, I speak in favor of the legislation. And first, I'd like to talk about the inherent weakness of living will, in fact, all living wills. As a practicing physician, and I understand where you're coming from, legal definitions, precision, concerns about the letter of the law, but unfortunately, medicine is not like that. Medicine has infinite zones of gray. What may be appropriate here may not be appropriate there. There is always a lot of head-scratching that goes on, and in fact, these legal precision terms that we're using, when it comes down to it, when push comes to shove, the physician talks to the families. The living wills, and I think this has already been expressed, represent a desire that is made known to the physician and made known to family and often a minister or religious leader by the patient or person who designates that living will. These act as guidelines for when a person does reach a terminal state. They are not usually considered binding. In other words, I myself would not be considered bound if someone signed a living will directive, and then the family came to me and said, well, we know that grandmother is ill, but we really do want to have everything done and see what happens. And the reasons that I would say, okay, but you understand that grandma did this and so, and this is what her desires are, and they say, we understand. And the reason that I would not necessarily be bound by this directive are two. First of all, every physician is concerned about getting sued. And it is not the terminally ill that do the suing, it's the family members that do the suing. So, in fact, we are concerned about good rapport with family. That is utmost in our minds. Not only rendering good care, but also doing that in a manner that the family understands what's going on and to a certain extent complies with that approach to medical care. The other concern is that if a family is concerned that a physician is not doing all that he could or is perhaps doing too much, it is within the power of family to dismiss a physician and find another physician. So that always rests with the family to have that final say, particularly if a patient is incapacitated, terminally ill, on a ventilator, you name it, but cannot make that decision for himself. So that there are inherent weaknesses of living wills that for all the legal maneuvering and all the precision that you might make, when it comes to the hospital corridors, it will still be the family, the patient, and the doctor that will come to the final resolution of this difficult ethical decision. And that brings me to the second point that I'd like to make, and that is the advantage of a durable power of attorney over health care. This is really, I think, a step forward in terms of dealing with these issues. It provides a patient who has a concern, has given some forethought to the way that he would like to die or exit this world, someone who's given that forethought to go ahead and elect someone that he has confidence in judgment. We would not necessarily delegate our financial matters to a consensus of family members. We would not delegate that to any individual who we did not have faith or confidence in. And the same thing should be true of a person who has concerns about their health in a terminal situation or a near-death situation.